Ta-da! Thank you. One of the other accomplishments which you forgot to mention was a comedian. I mentioned to somebody when we were talking about depression that on NPR News, that's National Public Radio in the United States, that somebody was interviewed, and it was one of the senior script writers for the most popular comedy show in the United States, Saturday Night Live. And on National Public Radio, he attributed his battle and successful battle with depression on hearing the YouTube talks of this Australian muck, which was me. So not only did I realize how successful those talks were in overcoming depression, but I also understood where they get all the material from for the funniest program in the United States, that in my life. They haven't acknowledged that yet, but nevertheless, I let it go. But it is also important to introduce the humor, the fun, and the playfulness into mindfulness. Otherwise, mindfulness just becomes so serious and also lacks some energy, which actually makes it attractive and also makes it very easy to follow. Many people, when they start meditation, always thought that meditation is hard. And I am a living example of how easy and fun it happens to be. But of course it's easy to develop mindfulness and joy and happiness and liberation and jhanas and enlightenment. Look, even in the time of the Buddha, there's many monks and nuns knowledgeable, from many different traditions. And you know, in the time of the Buddha, everybody seemed to be able to get enlightened. There were people who had not much education. There were people who were serial killers. There were people like Patachara who was mad and crazy. So if they could do it, why not you? Are there any serial killers? Are there any crazy people in this building other than me? Yeah, a few people put their hand up. So a lot of times it is because in the time of the Buddha, obviously had this marvelous teacher who really knew what the path was and could explain it. And so that is one of the reasons why we have conferences, to actually explain just exactly what we're doing and how beneficial it is and actually how easy it can be and how much fun the spiritual life can actually be, no matter from where you start. So, I know the title of the talk this evening is about jhanas, and some people say, wow, that's way above me. That is just too far advanced. But the way that those things happen are precisely the same way that people overcome their depressions. The same way that they let go of addictions. The same way that they have a better understanding on how to deal with the problems in life and have good relationships. Sometimes people feel that things like deep meditation and jhanas is only for the people who live in the forest, but it's also for those who live in the jungle, the concrete jungle of Toronto. and other places from where you've come. So, how can I explain this? There's one thing which I've noticed. This is for the serious Buddhists who actually studied all these sutras and studied the agamas and really got into those ancient traditions. They know sometimes there's a disconnect between, you know, what we know as the Dhamma, the teachings, and what people do in meditation. You know, one of the things which really drew me to Buddhism was its compassion, its kindness, its gentleness. Now, the image of a Buddha was always something which inspired me, you know, with kindness, with hope, never with any negativity. And I was telling a few people some of these anecdotes, which maybe many of you don't know, that one of my friends who went to UK many years ago from Australia, that he wanted to go and see a castle. If you go to a place like UK, you have to go and see a castle. They don't really have real old, ancient, hundreds of years old castles in Canada or in USA. I know that a few people actually buy old castles and they actually ship them stone by stone to the United States, but to see a real one is one of the must-dos if you go to a country anywhere in Europe. So he wanted to go to see a castle, and there was a castle close by, and it was closed, so they couldn't get in. So instead the host said, well, not far away from here there is an interesting place we can visit. It was the country home of the British wartime Prime Minister, Winston Churchill. So that might be interesting, and that was open. And when they went into the entrance to this old place where Winston Churchill spent, you know, most of his life, in the entranceway there was a painting of a Buddha. And the guide said that was painted by Winston Churchill himself, of an image, a real image, which was by his bedside throughout the Second World War. First time we understood that somebody like Winston Churchill had a Buddha statue right next to his bed when he went to sleep at night. And of course, people know the stress of life. Imagine being a person, a leader of a country, in the dire circumstances of a war, responsible for so many decisions which cost thousands, millions of lives. He had that as an inspiration and also as a source of hope. And that's something which now inspires me to have inspiration, hope, positive influence in the darkest times of depression. He also was a depressive. But those sorts of messages were something which could overcome the negativity of life. The compassion, the wisdom, those were the things which inspired me. But when I saw that in some traditions they are so fierce when they meditate, I thought, is this really Buddhism? I even went to a monastery when I was a very young layperson in the north of England, where they used the stick. I was sitting there early on a Sunday morning, and this man came in with a Zen stick. And I was always blessed with good karma. Somehow a very, very lucky monk, because I never got hit. The reason was the person meditating next to me was more sleepy than I was. He was the one who got hit first. And as soon as I heard that crack of that wooden thing on his back, I was so straight. All my sleepiness vanished. Not because I was actually out of fear. But coming back forward rather many years, when I was in Hong Kong and just having a chat, catching up with gossip from other monks. There was a monk from mainland China. I'm saying how things going for Buddhism and meditation in mainland China. And he told me this little anecdote, that at a retreat, a Chan retreat, which was being held there, that one of the masters there, they came with a stick, and there was one middle-aged woman who was sleeping, and she got whacked on the back of her back. And immediately she took out her cell phone and called the police. And the police came, and they arrested that monk and took him away. Be careful in our modern world. There's some things you can't get away with as a monk anymore. there's a kindness and compassion there. And so, mindfulness, awareness is great, waking up. But without kindness, there's something really missing. And all those, I'm reminded of this, all those people who are lining up to get your book signed and asking deep questions on life. It's only supposed to be a book signing, but nevertheless, it was enjoyable for actually to connect with people and to tell some of the reasons why you can get into deep meditation and why I could connect with you in the same way I could connect with my breath, with my mind, with the deep peace. Meditation can be described as the art of relating well to things. Being mindful is not something you force. It's a skillful training in how to be with something effortlessly, peacefully, and joyfully. How does that work? I gave in one of my books the simile of the phone call inviting you to the coffee shop. So, you get a phone call, and one per acquaintance says, "Are you free this afternoon?" And you say, "Yes." Please come to have a cup of coffee with me. I know you don't like latte coffee, you like flat black, but I like latte and that's what you're going to drink. And I know that you don't like chocolate chip muffins, but they are delicious. I'm going to have one and so are you. And I know you don't like going to this coffee shop, but I do, that's where you're going to come. We're not going to sit in the front, we're going to sit in the back. And we're going to not talk about your stupid spirituality and Buddhism. We're going to talk about politics, important stuff. And if somebody invites you and tells you where you're going to go, what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, and what you're going to talk about, and I forgot for how long, I can only spend an hour, so that's how long it's going to be. What would your reaction be? Your reaction would be to try like hell to get out of that. You say, "Oh, I've just forgotten. I have a dentist appointment this afternoon. Oh, maybe next week." And so you hung up. And to keep your precepts and not be a liar, you ring up the dentist and make an emergency appointment. We all have to keep our virtue. And as soon as you make that appointment, you get another phone call from another friend who said, "Are you free this afternoon?" You say, "Oh, I just made an appointment with the dentist." Oh, such a shame, because you say this coffee shop, in part of Toronto, you said they make lattes to die for. I know they probably do kill you with all that cholesterol and milk and stuff, but look, I would really love one of those to try it out. And you say those chocolate chip muffins, they're almost as good as Nirvana. So I want one of those as well. And you've always been talking about mindfulness and meditation, and I'm really interested. So can I come? And if somebody invites you to drink the coffee which you like, eat the food you like, go to the coffee shop which you prefer, and talk about the things which you're interested in, what would your reaction be? Your reaction would be, I'm cancelling the dentist appointment. I'm there. And does it really matter how long you spend there? If you're with a really good friend, a kind, sensitive friend, you stay there all afternoon. And you miss all the other appointments. Why? Because they're engaging you. They're enjoying, you know, your presence. And that is what stops you wandering away to somewhere else. Mindfulness, being the ability to be aware, not just for a few seconds, but for a long time, enough to settle down and get the great benefits of mindfulness, that is only happens not through force, but through this wonderful sense of joy and kindness. Being with something you appreciate, which is kind to you. So what happens in some forms of meditation, some forms of attention? You say to your mind, right, be mindful. Right. Say, be mindful of the breath. And that's too much force. Sometimes kindness means, mind, what do you want to watch right now? Mind, where do you want to go? Mind, what do you want to do? Because when I've been teaching for so many years, the first thing which people complain about is the mind wandering off all over the place. And when I talk to people about their lives, I hear about their husband wandering all over the place. And I can see the connection. Why? Why does that happen? You've got a bad relationship with your mind. I often thought that if your mind wanders off and you can't be aware of this moment, why? Because you've got a bad relationship with this moment. You haven't learned how to love one another. Not by forcing this moment to be like this or like that, by appreciating it. One of the ways to be mindful and also to get the deepest of meditations so you do pay attention is what I used to call the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. This was a story which was I first read from Leo Tolstoy in a book of short stories which I picked up in the library of Emmanuel College when I was a student. And it impressed me because it was an emperor who had it up to here with religions, always fighting each other and arguing who was the best. And we still have that these days, unfortunately, which really turns a lot of people against religion, Buddhism as well. Who's the best? So he decided to figure out his own religion. And he found that all you really need to find the answers for are three major questions, fundamental questions. And it also had to be something which he could relate to and use in his daily life. Not a disconnect between the spiritual life and the secular life, to find common ground. And that was, when is the most important time? Who is the most important person? What is the most important thing to do? And of course, when is the most important time? It's obvious, it's always now. Now is when your future is being made. If you want to get the deepest of meditations, they happen now, not in the future. Wanting to achieve something, a goal, looking for it to happen, it will never happen that way. Who is the most important person? That was the one right in front of you. And that, for those of you who were just sitting in front of me a few moments ago, having a book signed, photographs taken, questions answered. It wasn't answering your question which was important. I'm sure that many of you felt that I was connecting with you. I was with you, being with you. And sometimes that was much more important than any answer which you can get in books, you can get online. It was that ability to be connected, respected, to be actually have this wonderful little relationship that you, I hope you felt, at that moment were the most important person in the world for me. And that gives me huge amounts of energy. I should be tired. Look at my schedule. I only arrived in the US on Monday. Should be jet lagged. I'm over 65 years of age. I should be showing my age. I should be retired. The way I work, I should be dead. What I eat. That's not how this works. It's a relationship with this moment. And how that runs my life, this also runs my meditation, my mindfulness. Whatever is in front of my mind right now when I shut my eyes and meditate is the most important thing in the world. And now is the only time I concern about when I'm meditating. Straight away, that gives me a lovely angle on what this mindfulness is. Right now, most important time. What's in front of you right now? You, ma'am, are right in front of me. I'm connecting. I'm mindful. I'm giving you importance. When I try and push something away, you feel that. Number one, it takes a huge amount of energy out of me. I'm aware enough to know just trying to get rid of things, trying to control things to get to what I think is really important out of stupidity. That just drains energy out. But when I give something importance, give you importance, it's amazing just how much energy you have. You don't get tired answering question after question after question, signing books, having my photograph taken, signing books, having my photograph taken, signing books. You can do that for hours if you actually connect. And for me, that gave another little explanation, very simple, of what mindfulness is. To be successful in your life, but also have be successful in your meditation. So whatever's in my field of view, every moment is the most important thing in the whole world. I never try to get rid of it. I never try to diminish it or ignore it. If it's sleepiness, sloth and torpor, somehow or other, it's got something to teach me. I respect it. If it's right in front of me, that's my meditation object. If I'm in pain and sick, that's my meditation object. I give it importance, I don't diminish it. If it's restlessness, it's important. I'm with it, rather than trying to suppress it. I told many of you, I don't have many mental sicknesses, except a bit of craziness, telling the same old joke many, many times, but just to make it quite clear to you, I know that many of you have told me, you've read all my books, you see me on YouTube, you carry me around on your smartphones, so what the hell are you doing here? But, someone told me this anecdote, I don't care if it's true or not, but it makes a lot of sense. Albert Einstein. This is a science center, so it's worth mentioning one of the greatest physicists. When he first became famous, he was invited to the United States on a lecture tour. And no one really knew what he looked like, but they knew his reputation. This was the days before the internet. And so that when he arrived, they arranged a car and a driver to take him from university to university on the East Coast. And so after maybe 5 or 6 lectures which were all the same. If Albert Einstein can do it, I don't see why I can't. But this was all the same lecture, and one day, driving to yet another university, the driver, I was in discussion with Albert Einstein and said, "Look, I've heard your talk so many times, I think I can give it myself." And I think some of you could say, "Oh, well, I could give Ajahn Brahm's talk, I've heard it so many times." And so Albert said, "Okay, give it a try." And so when they got to the next university, they swapped places in the car, and the driver introduced himself as the famous theoretical physicist, Mr. Professor Albert Einstein. And Albert was the driver. And it's amazing how well it worked. You know, when the driver came up on the stage with all his eminent sort of scientists in the audience at this great university in the US, and Albert was sitting in the back, and it was so convincing. And so convincing that he got a standing ovation. But there's always one person in the audience who's a bit, you know, a smart, like I say, smart ass, and decided to check out if this really was Albert. So he stood up and asked this very deep question on special relativity. And at that, the driver said, "That is such a basic question. Even my driver in the back could answer that." So, I'm not really Ajahn Brahm, I mean, impossible. And any tough questions in the back of the bed, they can answer it. But just going back to being engaging with the audience, mindfulness is learning just how to give importance to this moment, no matter what it is. Not rejecting it. Somehow it's there to teach it. And also, the third part, the most important thing to do, is to care. And to understand that, because there's a few friends I've known for a long time, that is the story of one of the Sri Lankan young men who saw through school, always coming to the Buddhist temple from the time he was very young. And as he grew up, that he did very well at school, went to medical school, graduated as a doctor, and when he graduated, the first year as a registrar in one of the hospitals, he came to see me and said, "I can't do this job any longer. I need to retire." And after all of that time, study, sacrifice, doing exams, and finally graduating, you know, as a medical doctor, why he would want to give this up, you know, I had to ask, what happened? And what happened was he felt so guilty, such a failure, because that morning, one of his patients had unexpectedly died. It was tragic because there was a young woman, about 23, 24, and no one expected that her condition to turn so badly, so fast, that she died. And he thought he was responsible. And worse, he was the one who had to tell the husband that his wife had died. They'd only been married for a few years, and they were so much enjoying each other's love that telling the husband was such a painful thing to do. But even worse, he had to tell the husband not only that he had no wife, but his two young children had no mother. And I don't think I can convey just the sharpness of that pain of having to be the one to pass that news on to this young man. It was devastating. We say that word, but this was real hard pain. And he felt so responsible and guilty he thought, I can never do this job because that might happen again and I just can't face that. I can't do it. And that was where I told him that you've misunderstood the purpose of being a doctor. The being a doctor is not to cure people. That is not your priority. If you think that you have to cure people, you will go through this so many more times. You will have to fail. That's obvious. You can't always bring people from the sickness back into life. Sometimes they will go the other way and will die. But, I told him, if you make caring more important than curing, you will never have to fail. We can always care for people, but we can't always cure them. And so make caring your major priority in your career. And I said as a bonus, you'll probably discover that you'll cure many more people if you make caring the priority rather than getting rid of their sickness or infirmity. He got it. He's still a doctor, still a really good friend. And this is what I do. Somebody who comes with cancer, like someone just did, don't try and cure your cancer. Care for it. Care for the blood cancer inside your system. Care for your tumor. Don't try and cure it. Then it takes away so much of the stress, so much of the anger which actually caused that tumor in the first place. Also, who are you? Why do you always try and cure ourselves? I really am very opposed to the self-improvement movement. If we use mindfulness to improve ourselves, I'm not in that at all. That's not what I do. I don't agree with that. Who said there's something wrong with you? Instead, as I told a few people, one of the current stories which I say again and again, because it needs to be said and emphasized, if you ever think there's something wrong with you, that you are faulty, that you are damaged goods, please go and have a walk in the forest and find the most beautiful tree. And the mark you will find the most beautiful tree is the one which is twisted and bent and damaged. When you understand what we're talking about there, from your own experience, you will understand if you have trauma, if you are imperfect in some way, that if there's something other people say is wrong with you, that you are, number one, you belong. You belong as one of the trees in the forest. You should never be stigmatized, pushed outside, rejected, as thinking you're somehow you don't belong. Too many people suffer many mental illnesses because of rejection, thinking they're somehow different, faulty, that they have no self-worth. There's something fundamentally wrong with them. When you understand this tree in the forest similarly, you understand that you do belong. It's not that there's something wrong with you. And in fact, those trees which are most bent and twisted and damaged are the ones which I like the most. They're the most beautiful ones. Pick it out, your favorite tree. So you don't try and cure your wife of her spending habits, just like that person who gave his wife on Valentine's Day plastic surgery. He cut up all her credit cards. That's called plastic surgery. And as I say, many people say it's bad jokes, but those are the ones you tell your friends when you leave here. So no, You don't try and change people. You care for them. In the same way, you don't try and change yourself. You care for yourself. And that is where growth happens. If you're cared for, you actually grow and develop. Someone tries to cure you, and you get stunted and resentful and negative. You all know what I mean. So that is the emperor's three questions. Now the most important time, one in front of you is really important, and you care for it, you don't try and cure it. I found that so incredibly successful in relationships with a partner, the relationship with yourself, the relationship with life, which includes what people call tragedies. You care for these things. Don't try and cure them. The cure happens as a byproduct. The care is a fundamental way we deal with things. The great compassion which inspired me when I first came across the Dhamma. What's that got to do with jhanas? Everything. Whatever's in front of me, when I close my eyes, is the most important thing in the world. That's mindfulness. It really connects. I'm not trying to get rid of it, develop it, go somewhere else. If I'm trying to get somewhere else, I'm not really mindful of where I am. So, mindful of where I am, whatever's in front of me right now, it means I can always meditate. There's always something in front of me. I just connect with it. And to develop it, you care for it. You don't try and cure it. So, for those of you who are knowledgeable Buddhists, this is overcoming the first two hindrances of wanting something else, kamachanda, and also getting rid of vayapana, ill will towards whatever you want. And restlessness. Restlessness just by wanting to get somewhere else. What's wrong with now? Why do you want to go somewhere else? And also the tiredness, the sloth and torpor, which comes from just working too hard. And the doubt which comes from believing monks like me, books, experts, rather than the truth. Never let your learning and knowledge stand in the way of the truth of now. Obvious. But anyway, people always like to believe authorities and experts and dogma rather than what's right in your heart in this moment. As an aside, terrorism, extremism, where does that come from? Never in Buddhism, this path, you never just try and stop things through willpower. This is wrong. We must just use pest control to blot it out, to get rid of all the mice and cockroaches and pests in our kitchen. To get rid of our husband is a pest. To get rid of these other diseases which are a pest. To get rid of so much pest control, which is where we get violence from. So, no, that's why did those cockroaches come into your kitchen? Why did that mice come in? Why is, you know, you've got this terrible relationship with the person you love, with your sister, your brother, why? We find out the causes. Why? Does anybody want to drive a truck across a bridge and just indiscriminately kill and blow up children exiting from a concert? Imagine, how can you do that? And to me, it's, you know, the reason why is because we believe in dogma, what we taught, what's in the books, rather than what's in our heart. Anyone who's really mindful of how you feel when you hurt somebody, when you harm them, when you injure them, you can only be a bit mindful of what's in here rather than what's in the head, then it's impossible. I read a book a long time ago about the military But one of the difficult, this was actually British military, maybe 50, 60 years ago, they found that the big, most difficult thing was not to actually to get the best weapons, but to find some way of getting those strong soldiers to actually to pull that trigger. Because many, many soldiers, this was actually in the Second World War, it was either the enemy or me, one of us would have to die. But even though it was me or him, they just couldn't pull the trigger. They couldn't do that. And they got killed. This was an interesting psychology, that military have to somehow demonize, diminish the importance of the other in order to be able to pull that trigger, blow up that those people. To be, basically, to believe what you're taught rather than believe in your heart. And that is dogmatism. Mindfulness, when it goes with kindness, can be incredibly challenging, radical, because it makes you believe your heart. You would feel rather than believe. So this is a powerful thing which this movement is actually doing, especially when it includes the kindness. So now is the most important time. The one thing in front of you is the most important thing, and you care. You don't try and cure, which is pest control. You care. Just like the Gandhi or the Mandela. Powerful. Always look at someone like a Gandhi. Now, he got rid of the British Empire. You know, from his country. Not through violence. You know, I'm good on north of the border here. That was far more powerful than George Washington. I might get in trouble there, south of the border. Powerful stuff. So anyway, that is how we transcend what we call the hindrances and defilements in our mind. Not through battling them and kicking butt, which sometimes people do. Not by kicking butt with your emotional instabilities like schizophrenia or other diseases, but through caring. Always I'm inspired by this story, and Angie over there, one of the MCs, she managed to get me the invite to a conference in the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. And when I gave my presentation talking about things like this, I'd always remember one of the professors inviting me to do a blessing of his ward in this huge Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. And he said he was a Catholic. So I said, why do you want a Buddhist blessing? Just because I want to talk to you. And I said, what is your speciality? And he was a professor of schizophrenia. And I said, how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore? And he said, I do not treat schizophrenia in the schizophrenic ward of Singapore. When people say weird stuff like that, I really get interested. So what do you do? He said, I treat the other part of the patient, which is not schizophrenic. Just like I'd explained when I went to visit hospitals. I never tried to cure those murderers. I just didn't even see the murderer. Saw the other part, cared for them. Now that was radical. And that is why, as the monks and nuns in front of me know, you're not really supposed to put your hands up to a non-monk. But I couldn't resist. I worshipped that person. He's a Catholic, lay person, because I worshipped his wisdom. Wonderful. Sada, sada, sada. Someone's actually understanding and doing something. Not just the normal stuff, which doesn't work, by the way, but stuff which is radical, powerful, which I really agree. And I had to ask him, you know, maybe because I wasn't trained as a scientist, what's the results? Much better than conventional treatment. Not curing, but caring. And then something magical happened. So, meditation. If you want to get to the deepest states of meditation, how does that happen? Not by curing all of your defilements, your restlessness, your sleepiness, all of those other sort of attachments you have, but caring for them. I even said something radical to some today. How do I treat my addiction? Don't try and cure it. Care for it. Radical. Well, I bet that's going to be very powerful. When you care for it, by the addictions to thinking, you have to let go of the past and future in order to be peaceful in this moment. How do we do it? And over many years I was taught, your mind wanders off to some fantasy of the past or some fear of the future. Bring it back. And it wanders off again. Bring it back. Wanders off again. Bring it back. You know, I did that for years. What a waste of time that was. So instead, I learned how to care for my mind. If you want to wander off, fine. Off you go. With my permission. And the anecdote which I give for this is one of these really emotionally intelligent mothers who I got to know in Perth. Her 6-year-old kid threw a tantrum. Any mother knows kids do that from time to time. But this was a really wise mother. The kid said, "Mummy, I don't love you anymore. I'm leaving home." 6 years of age. And the mother said, "Wonderful idea. I'll let you pack. I'll help you pack." And so a little 6-year-old kid went to the bedroom with the help of the mother, got out a tiny suitcase and put all the important things for a 6-year-old to go out into the life alone. The Spider-Man suit, the teddy bear. And the mother said, "Before you leave, I will pack you a lunch." You know, it's a very hungry time out there in the big bad world. So packed a favourite sandwich, peanut butter and jelly on bread. And there at the front of the door, waved her son goodbye. "Have a wonderful life, son. Don't forget to write," because he didn't have emails then. And there the little 6-year-old carrying a suitcase in one hand and a brown paper bag with a sandwich in the other, walked off into the life, left home for the first time. Went to the end of the path, opened up the little garden gate, turned left and went down the road. Only 6 years of age. He got about 100 meters before the homesickness was too much. Turned around, came back, opened the garden gate, down the path, the mother hadn't moved. "Welcome home, darling." That is emotional intelligence. That is wisdom with compassion. And that is how I train people when their mind wanders off. If your mind wants to wander off, pack its bags, give it a sandwich, send it on, bye-bye, mind, have a wonderful time. If you are kind like that, rather than curing, your mind will come back almost straight away. Because it loves you. It cares for you. Respect it. Okay, that's just a metaphor, but you understand how that works. Maybe it's because my father told me when he told me the door, his heart is always open to me, no matter what I ever do. When he let me go and let me be, let me do whatever I thought I needed to do, something happened. You respected that trust so much. I couldn't let him down. I had to be a good person. Anyone who gives me such unconditional love, so valuable, so important, I can't throw that away. So, I don't know if he was emotionally intelligent or one of the best psychologists I ever knew, but it certainly worked. So I became a good person because I can't let a person like that down. You give a person freedom, and a lot of time, really appropriate, they never, never let you down. That's my experience teaching many, many people. So if you let your mind be, it stays with you. That's mindfulness and kindness. So what happens is as you become mindful and kind, your mind stays, it doesn't wander off. You don't get tired. The tiredness is the result of too much hard work, forcing your mind. You relax and you just wake up. What I notice with the mind, it is part of Buddhism, the Sankhara and the Vijnana, that we have a certain amount of energy, mental energy. Most of that is used in reacting, thinking, planning, worrying, useless stuff, which is a total waste of energy. So when you stop all of that, it just stops by itself, just by kindness. You don't need to do anything. This is good enough. You're content, no matter if you're sleepy, if you are thinking about all sorts of stupid thoughts. You are kind to your mind. You're kind to the future. You're kind to the past. Everything slows down and stops. You're not reacting, and all that energy is now freed up to be aware, to be mindful. It's actually you're diverting the energy which is being wasted into just being aware. That is one of the wonderful parts about mindfulness, empowering it, strengthening it. And that's the part which I really appreciate, because that's the fun part, the energizing part of mindfulness. For those of you who were talking to me, who said you should be jet lagged, you should be tired, working too hard, I was energized, because I wasn't trying to get rid of anybody. I wasn't planning what I was going to say. I was with you, not reacting, not bitching, not sort of complaining, right there. You can feel the energy just come right into your mind, being really aware, empowering mindfulness by having unconditional awareness. Not choosing, not reacting, not controlling, just letting it be with kindness, empowering it. Not only do you start to see more, you start to enjoy more. And this is what I saw in the suttas, in my own mind, now by luck first of all. When you let go, you're kind, you're mindful and peaceful, you start to wake up. The word Buddha comes from the Pali word Bhujati, which means to wake up. That's why I always say, the enlightened one, yeah, but is the awakened one, is a far more accurate translation of the word Buddha. You're waking up. Are you woken up yet? A lot of times we think we're mindful. There's so low power. When you really wake up and you really become alive, it's amazing what you see, which you've never noticed before. My classic tale, which you will remember because it's gross. Many of you know what's coming. My golden oldie. Was when I was teaching a retreat and I get really strong mindfulness, a lot of joy, a lot of peace, just like everybody else. You have to go to the toilet, the restroom. And for me, it was this time to do a number two. My mistake, I must never do this again, was to look in the toilet bowl. And what I saw there blew my mind. Wow! In all my life, I've never ever seen such a beautiful piece of shit. The brows. Now look, next time you get really deep meditation, look for yourself. Come and see. Ehipasiko. Find out for yourself, like the wise Pachatangwajitabha with you. Look at it. See, don't just doubt. It's all different colors of brown. Not just one shade, and just the way they react together, the counterpoint, it was just like some painting by some Picasso. I just couldn't believe just how amazing, beautiful it is, and just the way those little balls were put together. That was Michelangelo, like Rodin or somebody. And then, check it out next time. You'd always see a tiny bit of mucus on there somewhere, so it glistened like a diamond with the water on the top. And I was going, wow, look at that, in the toilet cubicle. And then I went on to the aroma. You know, the things like Chanel number 5, it's so superficial, so fake. This is real, earthy, natural. Again, check it out, just sniff it. Wow. That is powerful. And I tell, and this is honestly, I'm not lying, I'm exaggerating here. For a moment, I really thought of picking it up and showing my friends. You know, anything beautiful, you always want to share with others. But I didn't. It was such a difficult thing to do. I had to push that button on the top. It was attachment, I admit that attachment. But it's only all those years of training to let go. If I hadn't had all those training from Ajahn Chah how to let go, I would have never been able to do that. Press the button. Now, one of the reasons I tell that story, which is true, and other people have also told it, they've actually found out, yeah, the same. If you can see a piece of shit as beautiful, you understand where beauty lies. It doesn't lie in things outside. It lies in the power of your mindfulness. The more mindful of where you are, it's amazing where you find beauty where you've never expected it to be. And I quote at this point William Blake, 17th century English mystic and poet and artist, one of the phrases was, the phrase was to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. To see a world in a grain of sand, you have to be mindful. But the part I like the best is to see a heaven in a wildflower. So what does that have to do with jhanas? When you start to meditate, you find this mind, this crazy old mind of yours, is so beautiful. You don't want to cure it. You let it be. That's how we let go. We don't need to change it. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. If a piece of shit is beautiful, your wife is gorgeous. I was going to say husband. I said to husband the other day, but it's just, well, I didn't get there. So you start when you're looking at your mind, becomes amazing. So amazingly gorgeous. So you can't take your eyes away from it. Which means your mindfulness is stable. And it's not just it stays like that. It just gets more and more and more. Deeper and deeper, piti, sukha, happiness, joy. And this is our path of meditation. When it comes to Samanyapala Sutta, the second teaching in the Digha Nikaya, that was the first teachings which were listed in the books. That was when King Ajatasattu came and said, what the heck are you being a monk for? Get a life. To the Buddha, you are a royal person, you can have anything you want. And that's when the Buddha explained to a king who had everything, just how much joy there is in this path. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. And this is how it happens. The bliss is out there and in here, where we know how to be still and to care. We find that you care for your mind, it becomes really blissful, very still, and that bliss goes to levels which do blow your mind. So blissful is your mind, we call it the radiant mind. You're sitting there and it's just, sometimes you feel, like happened to me the first time, and also teaches to others that may have the same experience, that no human being can take so much pleasure. It's not physical pleasure, it's in the mind, the sixth sense. So beautiful. And what I've found is there's no limit to the pleasure which you can experience in the mind. It's not dangerous. Buddha said, don't be afraid of it. Follow it, develop it, make much of it. And that's, as a student, what you do. And it gets so powerful, it just envelops you. You're in the jhanas. Most blissful, amazing experience you've ever had. Much better than sexual orgasm. That's one of the reasons why I became a monk. What do you want to have sex for when you've got something much better? Sex, you know, get entanglements, kids. And people say, well, not everyone can do it. That's the wrong way of saying it. Not everyone will do it. But anyone can. Probably you won't do it, but the doors are open. If you learn just how to care and not to cure. But whatever is right in front of you is the most important thing in the world. Right now, forget about what's going to happen later. Enjoy this moment. Four Noble Truths: when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. This is a path of joy. Of bliss upon bliss upon bliss. It's not an intellectual path, but an emotional path. Which is one of the reasons why sometimes scholars just don't get it. Think too much. Just like the terrorist. Just like the ideologue. You can have all sorts of reasons for doing stupid things. Like standing for being the President of the United States. What the heck does he want to do that for? You know when, who was it, Bob Brown, I think he was then the Governor of California. Is he still the Governor of California? Jerry Brown. When he was standing for election and Democratic candidate for the President, because I was a young monk at the time, and he was a Buddhist. I thought, wow. A Buddhist is standing for being President of the United States. And then some of the other monks, you know, who were wiser than I was, said, look, he may be a Buddhist, but I don't trust anybody who wants to stand for being President of the United States. What do you want that power for? What do you want that problem for? This is actually like the Mara telling the Bodhisattva under the Bodhi tree. Don't become enlightened, be the world-turning monarch. You have so much, you can do so much good. You're missing something. Be a Buddha, be enlightened. Then you do something good. Don't try and cure the world. Care for it. Then it changes. So this, if you understand that, you understand the path into the jhanas. You care for your mind. Don't try and cure it. And just like in healthcare, you get far better outcomes. Diseases disappear in the weirdest ways when you don't try and get rid of them. Your children become far better children when you care for them rather than trying to train them, cure them. Again, just talking earlier about education. How many of your kids are stressed out and suffering because of the way that education is today? I have one of my monks from Finland. He just told me, and it's true, checked it out. You don't go to school until you're 7. There's no preschool. There's no first and second grades. You start school at 7. For the first 7 years of your life, you play. And when you do go to school, you don't never have any homework. Ever. No homework at the schools. And check out the rankings in the OECD. Those are the developed countries, such as Canada, such as the US, such as Singapore, Hong Kong, China. The Finland is always in the top 1, 2, or 3 in math, English, science, with no stress on the children. Why? Exactly the same way you can get into deep meditation. Don't push. Care. This is the most important time. Be here. Amazing stuff happens. Radical. Life-changing. But maybe the way of the future, and also the way into the dharmas. Thank you for listening. Very good. Now, the 3 C's, the questions, criticisms, and complaints. So who's going to be brave enough to ask the first question? Yes, at the front, at the back. Oh, yeah. So in the back. Oh, actually, it's in the middle. So that's a very good place to choose. The middle way is the best.
Question is from the article Case Study of Ecstatic Meditation, fMRI, Stimulating from the Reward System.
Yeah.
So according to this article, it says jhana meditation consists of a set of 8 sequential practices. From what I've heard, there's only 4.
Yeah, that's a bit of bullshit. Maybe if you read the books, it's very easy to not understand what those books are. It's not practices. It's much better to call them stages of letting go. Just what happens when you follow this path and you're just more and more still, more and more peaceful, more and more joy. You don't practice it, you don't do it. It's what happens. And you can say there's 8 stages of letting go. Deeper and deeper, things falling away. And more profound states of emptiness, nothingness, as you go deeper and deeper. Stages of disappearing, not practices. The word practice is called patipadā, in the Pali. It means just you're following a path. And, Siddhimagga, the path is, but no traveller on it is he. It's one of my favourite quotes. If you travel the path vanishes. If you vanish, then the path emerges. Get it?
The other work is, so by the way, I don't know if everyone else has seen this paper, but it's basically they have a meditating monk, and they basically take these fMRI and EEG scans while he enters his deep jhana meditation. And I found this article in the website of the conference. So I was just reading it, I didn't read it completely, but I was a bit confused with these some of the things they were saying compared to what I remember. So in this, they have a little diagram. They say jhana 1 is they describe it as physical pleasure. Does that make sense?
More bullshit. In some countries, they don't mind me using profane words like bullshit, but I defend that. According to the Dhamma, the Vinaya, and the Ranavibhaga Sutta, they said, and please remember this, monks and nuns, you should teach the Dhamma in the local language. You're using bullshit at home, therefore so should the monks. That's actually the advice of the Buddha. Because sometimes, you know, the monks are looked upon as being some sort of royalty. You know, maybe Queen Elizabeth is not allowed to say bullshit. Why not? That must be so frustrating for her. At her age, she could live on the wild side. And that's something that, you know, I always rail against. You know, just the limitations of not connecting with other people. Because of the language they're not allowed to use. So anyway, I use the Pali version these days in many places, Gomayang. So if you don't know the word Gomayang, Go is the ball, and Mayang is, well, I think you understand what that means now, what comes out of the backside of the ball. So it's a bunch of Gomayang. So physical senses passing away. It's the five senses vanishing, which gives you some of the bliss. This is vivicchehi kamehi. Kamehi in the plural of the word k long a m a, because there's a few monks over here, and I respect them a lot. In the plural, it always refers not to sensory pleasures, that's kamasukha. It refers to the five senses, like kamaloka, the five sense world. This is where those five senses actually disappear. They're not there anymore. And you're still perfectly aware, more aware than ever before. Really fully aware. And when they vanish, first time when they start getting very, very suppressed, subdued, is you see the beautiful light. We call it nimittas. They're described in the Upakalesa Sutta. Those nimittas, those lights, everyone would experience. If not when you're meditating, when you die. Those people who have near-death experiences, no matter what religion you are, you come back to tell the tale, you go towards the light. That is precisely the same thing, or similar enough, to what you see when you approach the jhanas. Why? Because when you die, what's the definition of death? Your five senses stop. Not because the light in your eye to see if the sense of sight is active. Even which I was reading an article that even the old way of actually shouting into your ear to see if there's any reaction was one of the ways of even modern technology just to find out whether that person's alive or dead. Whether their senses have actually stopped or not. Okay, you can put an MRI on to see if there's any brain activity or heart activity. In jhanas, there'll be flat lines. Perfectly alert. Awakened sign. But no sign of activity. And you come out upwards. Radical stuff, but that happens. That's separated. Vivicchehi, kamehi. Separated from the five senses. And of course, there's people actually experience those near-death experiences, actually sometimes merge into that life. And they describe it as pure bliss or pure love, like Angie, what was that lady's name again? Who wrote that book? Anita Mori or something?
Anita Mujani.
Anita Mujani, yeah. So I was fascinated by how she described that state. Ecstasy, pure love. They're one of the same things, just the way we describe those things. That's the description of the dharma state. So that's what it feels like, this dharma. So that's why I say you'll all experience it sooner or later. It's better sooner than later.
Thank you, Ajahn Brown.
Okay.
Next question. So I struggle with the concept of expectations causing suffering.
Yeah.
My question is, if I have no expectations, how is that different from just not giving a crap about it?
There is times to do something and there is times to let go. If you are going home this evening on the back of a motorbike, please do not let go in the busy traffic. But if you are meditating, that is 100% let go. And don't give a crap what happens. But that's a bit of a gross word. I learned a new word recently, the word nanya. Now this came about when one person on my retreat complained about her son. Have you done your homework yet, son? And he replied, nanya. And said, have you cleaned your room? Nanya. Have you taken the trash out? Nanya. She thought it was like an Aboriginal word. Until she confronted her son and said, well, what do you mean, nanya? He said, it's short mouth for none your business. So, remember that word when you're meditating. Past, none your business. Nanya. The future, nanya. Getting enlightened, nanya. You've got no business. So relax. Let it be. All the difficulty with the Trump, nanya. I've told a few people about the assassination attempt on Donald Trump. Have you heard about that one? Just recently, this person in one of his meetings stood up and pointed a gun at Donald Trump. Assassination, didn't you read about that? There was an assassination attempt on Donald Trump, pulled out the gun, pointed at Donald Trump, and one of the Secret Service people shouted out, Donald, duck! And the assassin broke down laughing. So Mr. Trump, nanya. You're in Canada, nanya. So whatever, anyway, that sometimes in meditation, can't you let go? Another little way of saying how to let go, none of your business, was, again, if you look at my bio, what I actually do, so much responsibilities and duties. I don't remember that time Angie was at the harbour, the Harbour Pavilion or something. I gave a talk, 1,500 people at the end of the talk. This guy came up to the microphone, he asked a question, he said, it's all very well for you to talk about all this stuff, Ajahn Brahm, you don't live in the real world, you don't know what it's like to have stress. And then I sort of, if someone's going to be like that of me, I was just going to give back as best I get. So I told him what I'd been doing that morning, getting up just before 4 o'clock, doing some work, and then all day, how much work I've been doing that day, until it was about 10:30 at night, You know, you really make me work hard in those days, Angie. But I enjoyed it. I had great fun. But when I told him how hard a mom monk works, he got onto the microphone again and said, well, I never thought monks had to work that hard. I always wanted to be a monk one day, but not now. I told him. So anyway, but yeah, when it's time to work, you work. But I was getting very tired, just doing all this stuff. And people would come and visit the place where I lived, this monastery over in Western Australia, in the hills. And they would tell me what a beautiful, peaceful, tranquil monastery this was. And I said, you must be joking! This is my work camp! There's all these monks to teach, lay people's questions to answer, building this, writing this book. Oh, it's so much work. And then I realized that I was being very stupid. I was mistaken. I couldn't see the peace and beauty which you could. So, in order to solve that problem, usually every Monday morning when I am at the monastery where I'm supposed to be the boss, I pretend, role play, to be a visitor, not an owner. When I change my perception to be a visitor, not an owner, I can see the same beauty which you see. I can experience the peace just like a visitor does. When somebody comes and asks me a question on meditation, I say, well, I'm not at work today, I'm only visiting. When one of the monks comes along and says he's fallen in love with a nun, he's just swerving and running away, well, not my problem. I'm only a visitor today. And that idea of being a visitor, not an owner, is a wonderful, skillful means of letting go, so you can appreciate the peace and beauty. I mean, all you monks, many of you run monasteries and temples, and you have so many responsibilities, but please be a visitor some days to the temple in which you live. I'm only visiting. I don't own the place. And those of you who have sicknesses and problems in your body, don't own your body, just be a visitor. Then it's nanya. Cancer? Nanya. I'm only visiting this body, I don't own it. Not my problem. And your meditation? You're only visiting your mind, you don't own your mind. So, mind your business. Mind wants to go this way, mind your business. Wants to go that way, mind your business. Don't be an owner. Be a visitor. And then you'll find a huge amount of peace. And just like the place where I live, I could never appreciate its peace and beauty when I was an owner. But I could when I was a visitor. So when you go home tonight, we look at all the dishes which need to be washed, and all the stuff which need to be done, and all the emails which need to be answered. Not my business, none yet. You're only visiting tonight. That way you can overcome stress. Peace. But if you own your life, and take responsibility for it, you're going to stress out. But not all the time, don't be totally irresponsible. But I only do that Monday mornings, not the whole week. I think you're mad, that'd be a really cool idea. But no, only Monday mornings, sometime when you can be a visitor to your body and mind, not an owner. No responsibility, none of your business. Okay. A question at the back there. Three questions. You have to run faster. Come on. Good exercise. Faster, 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 faster. Yes.
Do you think you can be?
No, I don't. Thinking sucks. Thinking is going to lead to so many problems and troubles. So I do not recommend it.
can someone be effectively mindful irrespective of whether or not they are fully awoken?
Of course, everybody is mindful, except if you're unconscious. It's just how strong is your mindfulness, and whether it's directed in the interested places, whether it's appropriate for the time and place. That's why how I was taught, it's in the suttas as well, you never just have mindfulness, it'll be always sati panya, sati sampajanya, same meaning, mindfulness and wisdom. You wouldn't have one without the other. Because mindfulness without wisdom, you're aware of you don't know which way you're going. You're aware you're falling into the big pit of shit. You see that happening. I'm falling into the pit. I'm falling into the pit. You know what you're doing, but it's pretty stupid to do that. So, mindfulness with wisdom. The other interesting part of mindfulness is that the word sati is also the word for memory. And sometimes it's used that way, you know, in the suttas. It's not just this idea of being aware. It's also being aware of, you know, the Dhamma, you know, the right way of doing things. It's almost like a shorthand for mindfulness and wisdom. It always goes together.
Thank you. Any more questions?
There's up here in the front. Look at the lady's hand is falling off.
So wonder if you could expand a little bit more on what you were saying about allowing your mind to go wherever it is that it wants to go. Because in the short time that I've been practicing, most of the people that I have listened to, the key that I've been taught is when you notice that your mind has wandered, that's the moment of mindfulness, when you bring it back to the breath or whatever object your attention is. But what I hear you saying tonight is let it go, let the child wander. So I'm just wondering if you could clarify that for me.
Yes, it's using wisdom, never control. If you use control and willpower, all you're really doing is wanting something. You're practicing what I call the third noble truth, part of meditation. The second noble truth, part of meditation. Wanting, controlling is a part of suffering. Being separated from where you are, from where you want to be, sorry. This woman came up to me once and she explained it so well. I've got to sort of balance the microphone to be able to do this. I need both hands. She said, in my life, this is where I am, now down here, and this is where I know I should be. And she said, I'm just so stressed out, trying to, you know, I know I can achieve this. I know this is where my life should be. There's so much stress. Here I am, and this is where I need to be. Please give me some advice. So it should be pretty obvious. This is where you are, this is where you need to be. How about knowing where you need to be to where you are? And then the problem solved. I don't know why people can't see that. But if you do let go, you have to let go properly. So if the mind still continues to wander off, the reason is this. Going through Singapore often, and Terminal 3, so often you go past the sports lounge. The big screen showing usually like EPL soccer. That's very well known loved in Asia. And I see people sitting on the seats there. Goal! Yay! Offside! That wasn't a goal. And this is a match which is happening in Liverpool. And they're shouting in the lounge in Singapore. And also, it's a replay. But have you seen people do that? You know, Sri Lankans watching a cricket match. That wasn't out. And you're watching it in Toronto.
It's happening in England. They can't hear you, but don't just, you know, diss on the men. Have you ever seen your wife watching a movie? It's only a movie. Why are you getting so emotionally entangled? That always concerned me. What is actually happening there psychologically? Psychologically, sort of when the guy is watching the sports match, they may be sort of 1,000 miles away, but psychologically they're actually in the ground. They're actually right there. And that sort of delusion is why they think they can shout and just get some response from the umpire. And when you're watching a movie, you actually get entangled into it, you're drawn into it. It may be some sort of Chinese movie in the time of the Ming Empire, and you're back there. And you're actually part of it. That hero, you know, may be your brother. And so you cry when he gets shot. You get entangled. That's what the art of the movie is actually to pull you in and get entangled. That's exactly what happens when you get entangled in your fantasies of the past or the future or thoughts. They're important to you and you finally have an emotional content. They're not real. And don't ever think your past is accurate. What was it somebody said? Your past is not interested in fidelity, is interested in coherence with what you thought should happen. And your fantasies of the future, it is what you want to happen, it's not what will happen. It is a total waste of time. You cannot trust the past or the future. They are just like the movies. Just like your fantasies of Sri Lanka winning the World Cup one day. So forget it. So that is just how we get entangled in the thinking process and the fantasies. That is why they don't become, they keep on going. So it is letting go. Letting go with wisdom. What usually works is just, if you just stand back, put some physical separation. Imagine that. Between you and your thoughts. Just like put some separation between you and the cricket match. You feel, look, I'm in this sort of my lounge room, sort of in Toronto. That's happening in Colombo somewhere. I can't sort of shout. No one will hear me. You don't get entangled. This is just a movie. And if the hero gets killed, wait until the movie is replayed, and then you will understand the truth of reincarnation. The hero is alive in the next showing of the movie. So when you disentangle, it's again none of your business. Then you find, with the letting go and the not getting entangled, then that's how you become peaceful. But just trying to force the mind to stop just feeds it. It feeds the restlessness. Any more comments, questions, criticisms, complaints? Our complaint? Yeah, go. At the back, where's the microphone gone? No, good. Yeah, over there, yeah. Can't be mindful.
We have time for one more question.
Your answer.
How can we find the balance between caring for others in the world and not being overwhelmed?
Ah, okay. And again, it is the balance of service and solitude. So often that people who are very compassionate forget somebody. Have I got time to? Yeah, come on, don't make me go over time. The 7 monks meditating in the cave. Once upon a time, if you're sitting comfortably, there were 7 monks meditating in a cave deep in the jungle on loving kindness
giving joy and happiness to all beings indiscriminately, just like the sun shines on everybody without choosing. And a bunch of thieves found that cave in the jungle. And these were very bad people. Made ISIS look like pussycats. And they realized this cave was a great hideout for them. They could store all their stolen goods and lay low until the heat was down and the police stopped looking for them. But there was one problem. The monks had found the place first. So they decided to kill all the monks so they wouldn't be able to say where the cave was. But the head monk, the boss, he was very, very smart. He said, well, why do you want to kill us? Because we don't want you to tell where the cave is. We won't. How can I trust you? So in the end, they came to a deal, the best the head monk could get. The thieves said, we will kill one of you, just to show how serious we are. And to warn you that any of you we let go, any one of you tells the authorities, we'll come for you, and we will kill you too. Just to show how serious we are. And that's the best the head monk could do. One would have to be sacrificed so the others could go free. And the head monk had this terrible decision to make. Who will be sacrificed? Now, the seven monks, I'll tell you who they were. And listen carefully, because I'm going to ask who you would choose if you were the head monk. Now, these seven monks, if you heard it before, shut up. The seven monks was the abbot, the head monk. And also his brother, they become monks together. And the next one was his best friend. You know, if you've got a good friend, the best friend will do anything for you. Even sacrifice his life for you. That's a sign of a real friend. A friend in need is a friend in need. And the fourth monk was like an enemy. Look, we have to admit it in monastic life, sometimes we just don't get on with each other. It's just human nature, it's just personality clashes. So, the fourth monk was the enemy, and the fifth monk was a really old monk. So old that he could die any day. And the next monk was even, they didn't know the next monk would die first, because he was a very sick monk. Always really sick and feverish and weak. So the next monk was a sick monk, and again, they're both about to die anyway. And the last monk was the useless monk. Whenever they did any meditation, that was the one who snored. Chanting, always out of key. Could never keep his robes on properly. And I often say, and I think the monks will probably agree with this, every monastery has one, a useless monk. I think I've got a couple. So, those were the seven monks. The head monk, the brother, the best friend, the old monk, the sick monk, I don't remember that one out, the enemy, and the useless monk. So if you were the head monk, who would you choose? I hear himself. Put your hand up and think that's the right answer. Himself. Now put up properly. The last time I was in the US, in Sacramento, we had an Episcopalian bishop came to the talk. I asked him this question. He put his hand up straight away, himself. And with great glee, it's called Schadenfreude, I said, wrong. Because I think many of you know the answer. The answer was, there was no way the head monk could choose. His love towards his best friend was no more, no less than love towards his brother. He loved the enemy the same as he loved his brother and best friend. Even the old monk and the sick monk could die any day. He loved them the same. And even if they're all useless monks, they often say that the useless monks in Bodhidharma Monastery, you love them. The place would be the same without them. And most importantly, you love all of those monks exactly the same. Those of you who've just been to Bodhidharma Monastery, you know which monks I mean. You probably could guess, you probably get it right. But, and the last of all, he loved himself no more, no less than all the other monks. The compassion goes equally to all, but we usually forget ourselves. We sacrifice ourselves for others. That is not loving kindness. We don't treat ourselves equally. So sometimes that's one of the big problems in life. So yes, care for others, but care for yourself as well. And to put it another way is, I did this only a few days ago when I blessed the marriage. Looked into the eyes, this time to the groom. So you're married now, you must not think of yourself. From this moment on, you're a married man. No more selfishness. He agreed, he got that. Looked at the new wife, you must not think of yourself. She agreed too. No, I'm married now, I'm not going to think of myself. And then you get the fun part. And I looked at the wife and said, you're married now, from this moment on, I don't want you to think about him, your husband. And then turned to the husband and said, now you're married, I don't want to think of your wife anymore. Come on, you've heard this before, you know the answer. And it's great because people miss this all the time. So once you're married, you don't think of yourself, you don't think of your partner, you only think of us. You get it now. Mahayana Theravada, Mahayana, the idea of sacrificing yourself for other beings. Theravada is totally Gomayan, that you know, you're in it for yourself. Your own enlightenment. Both of us is totally off, wrong. It's always, will always be, no matter what type of Buddhism you are, it's always about us. So that answers the question. It's not about you caring for other people. It's not about you caring for yourself. It's caring for us. If you understand that, you understand the answer to your question. It's about us. Not about sacrifice, not about selfishness. About us. Okay. That's it for this evening, folks.
On behalf of all of our attendees and
me as well, I'm including us.
And all the conference organizers and all our amazing volunteers, we would like to thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for being here with us tonight. For sharing all your insights, your wisdom, and of course, your tour.
Yeah.
You had a decision, so thank you so much.
Nanya.